Anything? I've tried them all. It keeps going straight to voicemail. Well, there has to be an explanation.
Sweetie, it's Vegas. You lose track of time in those casinos. There's no windows. There's no clocks. He's probably on a heater. And you never walk away from the table when you're on a heater.
You do if you're getting married.
Hello?
Hey, Tracy, it's Phil.
Phil, where the hell are you guys?
I'm freaking out.
Yeah, well, listen, I screwed up your wedding cake.
What are you talking about?
Your wedding cake, it's gone. A hilarious story, actually, although you might not find this funny. I told you I hadn't made one of these before, and things are going really well with it. I decided I would get creative with the cake. As you know, I've got a tendency to get over my head a little bit. So I decided I'd put some marijuana in it, because, you know, we can get it pretty easily out here. Anyway, I made the cake, I frosted it, and it looked great. And actually, I baked a little test cake so I could tell what the cake was going to taste like, and it tasted great. I was really proud of myself. But on the way to deliver the cake to you, I got the munchies really bad. I mean, seriously, like I was about to eat my own shoe. So I decided I would sample the wedding cake.
What?
Yeah, I sampled the cake. And one thing led to another, and I ate the whole thing. I'm pretty impressive, actually, if you think about this. I mean, I don't know anyone who's actually ever polished an entire wedding cake by themselves before. I'm pretty proud of myself, to be honest. I even ate the bride and groom ornament on the top. I'm not sure how that's going to turn out later.
What are you saying, Phil?
We're getting married in 5 hours.
Yeah, you are. Without a wedding cake.
Hey everybody, welcome back to My Life as a Foodie.
Oh,
back against the wall. Sorry for the delay. I was in Sonoma and Napa, and I have a whole story about that to tell you, but since it's been a month since we actually produced a show, maybe over that now, I've got a lot to say, so I kind of have to be concise. I was going to dedicate this show to baking, but I'm not being a very good podcast host lately. Some stuff is going on that's kind of taken precedent. Dude Food is also impeding my progress, and the show's taking a hit because I don't really watch stats all that often, but because I was about to do the show, I decided to go check stats just to see how things are going, and I am taking a major hit. We'll just put it to you that way. The last show, I think, is a tenth of what the previous show was. In fact, it might even be lower than that. So I got to get back on the horse and try to do Dude Food a little bit, work on it all the time or something. But I got work and everything else going on, so it's just kind of tough to keep up with everything. So here's the deal. I was going to talk about baking, right? And I don't really have the time to go into the stuff I wanted to talk about. But the deal is, it was a long-standing joke that I could not bake. And after a while, it started to hurt my feelings a little bit because people come over, and I knew I could bake. I just didn't have the patience for it. You know, I'm a stand and stir, pinch of this, pinch of that kind of guy. And you can't do that with baking. The rules are very strict with baking. Measurements are precise. And until the damn thing is finished baking, you have absolutely no idea what it's going to taste like. You know, if cooking is American democracy, baking is a lot more like Nazi Germany. You know, is that a fair comparison? I don't know. Anyway, it's we'd have these dinner parties, and now, if you're a lot like us, we plan way ahead, and we know that we're going to have a dinner party. So the menu is usually figured out a week in advance. I'm planning and I'm shopping days in advance. I'm doing loads of prep the night before. I work all day on the dishes, making sure everything is timed just right, just like a restaurant. And dinner goes off perfectly. But when it was time to serve dessert, it was usually a pre-made cake or a pie or something that I didn't bake myself. And only a few friends that we'd invite who could actually bake would bring dessert that didn't suck. Otherwise, it was something that was store-bought. And it just didn't seem right to do all this work into a meal just to have dessert be something just, I don't know, something you wouldn't remember. So finally, I decided that this chink in my cooking armor had to go, so I needed to tackle it. And it wasn't a problem for me, seriously. Baking was not an issue. I just had to stop and realize that this isn't something I could really control. I just had to follow a recipe. So I decided to start making things like chocolate souffle, creme brulee, ice cream, cookies, all kinds, brownies, you name it. The only thing I'm not really into baking is a cake, because I just don't care about it. And I don't eat that much cake anyway. We're not cake people. But all it really did was it took patience and the willingness to make one more additional dish at our parties, which is never really an issue. And so the monkey's off my back, and I thought about this, because on Top Chef, cooking a dessert has always been the Achilles heel of these chefs. In the first season, Tom Colicchio walks into the kitchen, and he finds this empty box of cake mix in the trash. And he says, what the hell is this? He wanted to know why they were using boxed cake mix instead of actually baking a cake. And this went on for years until recently, and now, you know, a lot of these chefs are bringing, you know, a baked item to the table or a dessert item to the table because they know that they're going to ask him to do it. So I didn't feel bad about not being able to bake because they couldn't either. And I can't bake nearly as well as, you know, some people that we know. I've got a friend, David, who is just out of his mind. This guy could definitely open a baking shop or, you know, bakery or something. And a few of Katrina's cousins, you know, are really talented when it comes to, you know, baking cakes and cookies and shortbreads, things like that. But I can do enough to get us by at dinner parties, and it's delicious. It makes me feel more like a, you know, a well-rounded home cook. But I was going to go into recipes and other stories and stuff, but I'm just not I'm not in the mood to do that, because something happened when we got back from our trip. We go, you know, we take this trip a lot, every other year. Sometimes we'll do it 2 years in a row. We go to Sonoma, and there's a big art show up there. My wife collects these art pieces. And these original art pieces that these artists produce, and they're outstanding. And so that's usually on a Saturday, and we'll end up going to the show, and then we'll go up a couple days before, spend a couple days up in wine country, and then lead in, and the show basically happens Saturday morning. You know, she buys some stuff, and then we get in the car, and we drive home. So we get home, and Katrina is catching up on Oprah on her DVR, right? She watches Oprah. And in one of the commercial breaks, they run this ad for a news story on Channel 7 here in L.A. that they're going to do that is exposing fraudulent activity at farmers markets. And as it turns out, there are a number of farmers here in the Southland, as we call it, the Southland, who are selling produce that they didn't grow. And I had highly suspected some of the people who are selling produce at our farmers market in Buena Park that we've been going to for 3 years, that I've featured here on the show and have talked about ad nauseum. And I suspected some of them were not growing the things that they were selling. And the reason why is, and if you remember, this was a long time ago, it was either episode 2 or 3, I went to the farmers market where we discovered it that day. And I brought my iPod with me, and I had a little microphone attached to it. And I went up to each one of these vendors, and I started asking them about their farms, where they grew their stuff, you know, what was this, what was that. I mean, we saw a lot of stuff we'd never seen before. It was a real education for us. And some of the farmers didn't really have good answers to my questions. Like I'd ask, where is your farm? And I'd get, oh, all over the place. Your farm is not all over the place. Your farm is in one spot. Where is it? And usually they'd say, Bakersfield. And I go, okay. Well, that's not really a local farm. Bakersfield is far away from here. In fact, Bakersfield, I drove from Bakersfield home. It's quite a few hours from here. Now imagine driving 3 hours to sell your stuff at a farmer's market. How much are you actually selling there? And then you're driving 3 hours back. Are you making any money? So now I'm thinking to myself, maybe they're basically selling it at more than one location, and the rest of it they're selling to places like Zion Market, where I shop, you know, on a weekly basis. It's about a mile from here. I buy my pork belly there because they sell, you know, heritage breed pig there, and Wagyu beef, and a lot of produce. And I look around this place, and I think to myself, this is the same stuff that we're buying at the farmer's market. It's the exact same stuff. Now, the thing is, at Zion, I'll walk up to produce, and I'll look at it, and then I'll look at the sign above it, and it'll tell me where it's from. It'll say product of USA, product of Mexico, or some other place. Or sometimes it'll say product of California, real California carrots, real California strawberries, local. Well, local enough. It's in California. So as I'm thinking about this, one of these characters, his name is Jesse. Frutos Farms, I think is the name of the place. He says he's in Cypress. And I was interested because that's an Orange County farm. And I really don't see too many Orange County farms. You see a lot of fields. You see a lot of farm stands, but they're not selling the things they're growing. And this guy, I ask him some questions about, you know, some of the produce he has, and I notice it's starting to wilt. And I thought, well, if you just chopped that down or just pulled it out of the ground yesterday or this morning, there's no way it would be wilty already. Unless, you know, it got hammered by heat or something. And I'd ask questions about his farm. Where is it? He told me, one time he told me Cyprus. Another time he told me another city. I can't remember. So I thought maybe he has multiple farms. But this whole no pesticides thing, they've got big banners and they talk like salesmen. You know, come buy my strawberries 2 for $1. Or, you know, they're pitching. And farmers don't pitch. And this guy didn't really look like a farmer. He didn't have the hands of a farmer. You know, these guys are wearing hats on backwards and Nike shirts. And they just didn't, I don't know. Maybe because maybe they're a different kind of farmer. I didn't know. But I'd ask him stuff like, you know, can we come visit your farm? And I gave him my card, my podcast. And I said, you know, it'd be great to actually go to your farm and feature your farm on my show. Oh, there are laws against having people on the property. Okay. I go, well, can we buy stuff from your farm? Like, do you have a stand there? Oh, no, there's regulations against selling directly on the farm. We can't do that. So, wow. So anyway, Katrina, of course, missed this report because we were in Sonoma. So we get back, and she decides to look it up online. Because, you know, if they'll run a special expose on something, usually they'll have a report on the web. They'll actually replay it on the web. And so she found it. And I want to play it for you now. Listen to this.
Farmers markets are popping up in nearly every neighborhood, wedged between office buildings, next to shopping malls, in parking lots. They're wildly popular with shoppers like Jamie Hoffman, who buys her produce every Sunday at the Larchmont Farmers Market in her neighborhood. Do you come here so you're buying local?
Absolutely. It's all about local and getting directly from the farmers.
But where does all this produce really come from? And are the claims some farmers make really true? We found 4 different pesticides in your berries. Our investigation began this summer. We went shopping at farmers markets across the area and asked a lot of questions.
Where's this grown? In Irvine.
Then we made surprise visits to farms where we were told the produce was supposedly grown. State law says farmers market vendors are supposed to sell produce they've grown themselves. And in fact, we found plenty of vendors doing just that, like Underwood Farms, which sells produce at 14 markets, all grown on this family farm in Moorpark. Farmer Craig Underwood.
Everything we sell at farmers markets is grown right here.
But our investigation also uncovered vendors who are selling stuff they didn't grow, like Frutose Farms run by Jesse Frutose.
First time here?
We bought from his stand at the Century City Market.
$5 for 3.
At the Buena Park Market.
15-6.
And at the Larchmont Market, where we bought items like celery and avocados. All told, we bought 26 different items from Frutose Farms stands.
Is everything grown in Irvine?
Yeah.
Irvine, their state permit says their farm is in Cyprus.
Everything you sell at farmers markets is grown in your Cyprus field?
Correct.
Everything?
Yeah, everything.
But when we made a surprise visit to the Cyprus field listed on their permit, Jesse couldn't show us most of the produce he was selling, like celery.
Can you show me where you're growing celery?
Celery? I don't think I have celery. No, I don't think I have celery.
What do you sell at the farmers markets that Frutose Farms didn't grow?
Garlic. I can say that.
And what about the avocados he sells? Do you grow avocados anywhere here?
Avocados? No, not here in the lot.
Where do they come from?
I'll be honest, that still came from somewhere else.
Somewhere else? We follow Jesse's truck on market days and saw him going to the big wholesale warehouses in downtown L.A. We saw him buying produce and loading up his truck with boxes from big commercial farms as far away as Mexico. He bought many of the types of items we saw him selling at farmers' markets. Back on the farm, Jesse made an admission.
You are selling some things you didn't grow that you got at wholesale produce markets.
Yes.
And we investigated other vendors.
Are you the owner?
Yes,
sir. Like Juan Uriostegui of Redlands, who sells at the West Hollywood Farmers Market on Mondays.
What's that broccoli?
We bought some of his broccoli, but when we showed up at his farm with the county agricultural commissioner,
we need to make sure that you grew what you sold on Monday.
He said he had grown broccoli recently, but could only show us this patch of dirt.
I'm looking at the field saying, I don't think you grew that broccoli.
In fact, he was already cited and fined earlier this year for selling produce that he didn't grow at another farmer's market. And we investigated another big claim made at farmers' markets. Notice that many farmers say their produce is pesticide-free.
They're pesticide-free.
So we bought a container of strawberries.
There's no pesticides or fungicides.
From five different farmers, including this one at the Beverly Hills Market and another one at the Torrance Market from a vendor called the Berry Best.
These are pesticide-free?
Yes, they are.
To see if that's true, we took our samples to a state-certified lab and had them tested for pesticides. Results showed three out of our five samples did contain pesticides, including that sample from the Berry Best.
Are you the owner?
Yes.
We caught up with the owner, Mary Ellen Martinez, at the Westwood Farmers Market and asked why she displays those signs saying pesticide-free.
Tell me what.
I have that sign up. A lot of people went by.
We found four different pesticides in your berries.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how that happened?
Nope.
She said pesticides might have drifted onto her field from a neighboring farm.
So, when they do spray, it may fly a little bit.
But the lab that did our test says that's unlikely, because it says the pesticide level on her berries appears too high to have drifted from another farm. She cut off our interview.
You're getting on my nerves right about now.
But I haven't really gotten an explanation.
By the end of our investigation, we found dozens of vendors who make false claims selling at farmers' markets. And what would the thousands of loyal customers think if they knew a lot of vendors are selling produce that's not local or pesticide-free?
I feel like I want to take my vegetables back.
I've known this farmers' market, and a lot of them that I suspected weren't real farmers. I mean, at the farmer's market, you expect to see farmers or people from the farm selling the food. A lot of them, it was a tough nut to crack because Katrina refused to believe they were selling us stuff that they weren't growing. And I kept telling her, I don't think this place is legitimate. For one thing, I would find tags on our food. You know, those tags when you go to the grocery store and they're tagged with an item number, there were tags on the food. I go, why would there be tags on this food if they just picked it? Why would they be putting tags on it? And I'm not saying that the food we bought from them was bad, but we're buying it under false pretenses. We're trying to support farmers by buying directly from the farmers, cutting out the middleman. And we weren't doing that. They're buying their stuff wholesale from other growers. They're vendors. They're not farmers. I mean, I really don't want to travel 20 miles each way, spend the gas and the time, and have to get cash because they don't take, credit cards or checks, just to get this stuff, and I can get the same produce that's being made available to me less than a mile from my house, and I can support a local store. As I walked into the produce section at Zion Market, like I said, I realized, it's huge. It's like the size of Whole Foods, maybe bigger. It was like an indoor version of our farmer's market, because I saw the very same things. All this stuff looked the same, but it had tags on it, because it would tell me, what farms it was grown in, or sometimes they'll say, product of Mexico. And if that's the case, I won't buy it. At the farmer's market, they're claiming that they're growing everything. Zion's not doing that. They're not saying, hey, grown by Zion. No, they're not. They're telling the truth. I just want to know the truth, because you don't know where the stuff is coming from. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we were more than likely purchasing and eating vegetables that were grown in Mexico or further south. And that pisses me off, because that's exactly what I'm not, I'm trying to avoid that at all costs. And if I'm pissed off about anything, it's that. At Zion, they marked it. In the supermarket, it's marked clearly. Product of USA, product of Mexico, or grown in California. It doesn't say grown by Albertsons, because they don't grow vegetables. But these vendors, because I'm not calling them farmers anymore, these vendors were pulling the wool over our eyes. And I feel like a douche. Now, should this be a surprise to me? Absolutely not. No, because I've got a lot of history about being a gullible jerk. I can have the wool pulled over my eyes very easily. I'm extremely gullible because I believe in people. And maybe that's my fault. And I think about it. Look around here. There aren't any local farms, really. There are big areas where food appears to be growing. And there will inevitably be a farm stand. Because that's good merchandising. If you put a farm stand on a farm, people are going to buy from you because they're thinking that they're buying stuff that you're growing. And isn't that like just the most romantic thing as a foodie? To walk up to a farm and say, oh, I just pulled this out of the ground. Here you go. The fact of the matter is, no matter what they're growing at these places, a lot of it's not being sold in those stands. There's one 3 miles away from my house. I was on a run one day, and I made a part of my route, and I saw artichokes. And I stopped and I looked around. I go, wow, they're really growing vegetables here. So we made it a point to visit that stand, and everything that they sold in that stand looked sick, old, mushy, and it was expensive. And I looked closer, and a lot of it was from Mexico, as it said there, made in Mexico or grown in Mexico. It's like every time I visit one of these stands, it's the same thing. With the exception of the stand we visited in Sonoma last weekend, it looked like a farm, but they didn't grow anything that they sold either. But at least everything that they sold listed the farm and the location of the farm, so you knew where it was coming from. Not as impressive as buying directly from a farm, but, you know, hey, at least it's fresh and semi-local. And that's more than I can say about what I've been filling my refrigerator with for the last 3 years. So deep down, I think I owe you guys an apology for shoving my farmer's market down your throat. Not to say that you shouldn't still shop at your farmer's market, but the key is, and the lesson learned here, is to definitely ask questions when you're there. If they're going to pose themselves as farmers, they shouldn't have any problem answering the questions that you have. Where's your farm located? How long have you been growing? What else do you grow? What's in the ground right now that isn't growing yet that will be in season, and when will that be available? Simple questions. Farmers are really into what they do, and they love to answer questions. They love it. They love that you're interested in what they're doing and what they're growing. If they hesitate or grow irritable that you're asking these questions, you're onto a stinker, more than likely. So move on. Don't buy anything from them. I'm going to put a link to this if you guys want to watch the video. It's shocking. When I saw this guy's face in this report, I just wanted to punch the screen. This is the same guy with the same bullshit line he was giving me. You know what happened? It was during this period when I started to talk to him a lot, and I was asking questions. And he didn't seem that happy that I was asking so many damn questions, but who gives a shit? I was contacted by Heath Putnam at Woolly Farms. Woolly Pig, sorry. Up in Seattle area. He grows Mangalitsa pigs. And he had asked me if I knew anybody who raised pigs down here in Southern California that might be interested in raising Mangalitsa, because his goal is to get this breed of pig from Austria all over the place. So what did I do? I asked Jesse. I said, do you know any farmers who raise pigs around here who might be interested in purchasing a couple of these pigs and raising, you know, this breed and starting to grow stock in this breed? He goes, oh, my uncle's a pig farmer. I'll ask him. I said, where does your uncle grow pigs? He goes, oh, Pomona. So I'm thinking, wow, Pomona, really? So through a bunch of stuff that I've been doing personally, I've been trying to find a source for pork. I've been trying to locate a farm that raises pigs. And through the Pork Council, they list all the farms that raise pigs and what kind of pigs they raise. And guess what? There isn't a single farmer raising pigs south of me, which basically is what I'm asking. South or east, to be honest. I think the closest farm that raises pigs, according to the Pig Council, is somewhere north of Los Angeles. I think it's in Ventura or Lodi or something like that. It's way up there. Nowhere close to Pomona. Beef, chicken, goats, I think that's it. Not much more than that. But there aren't any pig farmers. And he never got back to me. And I gave him my card and I said, I'm really interested. At least have your uncle call me. Nothing. As he's a liar.
Farm Burger at its roots is a neighborhood burger joint. And so, but it's done a little bit different. My partner is Jason Mann, and we have two lovely farms up outside Athens.
My expertise is really translating the field to the consumer, to the eater.
They're turning over all the land, which is what people do with machines, but, you know, we do it with the pigs.
If most folks really saw how their food was produced, they would not be able to stomach the cost, the true cost involved with the eggs they get at their local big box store. They wouldn't feel good about eating the pork or beef that is 99 cents a pound. Yeah. I think farm to table is, you know, a nice microscope into the other side and what it possibly could be. It's a lot about co-production. It's like co-authoring or co-producing a film. The farmer is intimately involved in a way that the chef is proud to sing their song to their consumers.
Arugula from Serenby Farms. Really nice, strong peppery flavor to it. Super fresh. This stuff was harvested yesterday.
When this opportunity arose to work directly with a farmer, it was amazing.
This is pork that I got from Jason. And then we have a little spicy slaw.
And what we also do a little bit different is we're not just farm to table, we're farm and table. So farm and table means that the restaurant, the tables are ours, and the farm and the pasture and the animals and the crops are ours as well. So we have a great involvement in the production of everything we do, from how we raise our animals to how we cook our burgers in the end. There's a lot of people who come in and said, we only eat grass-fed beef. Now we can go out and get a burger.
And when they say grass-fed, they had me at that because I wanted something that didn't have the hormones and all the other things.
I like the idea, too, of breaking out of the corn cycle.
The relationship with the Georgia farms, I think that's important. You got to support our local farms.
It's a great burger. That's why I come.
We knew that if we could create a superlative hamburger that represents the politics, the principles, the pleasures of everything a hamburger could and should be, we had faith that the people would respond to it.
Sean Paxton, the homebrew chef, has a show on the Brewing Network called The Homebrewed Chef, and it's fantastic. I could talk about this guy forever, and I can't say enough good things about him. He's not only one of the nicest, most generous, giving people that I've ever met, but he's also really willing to share his knowledge of cooking, food, beer, and beer pairings. It doesn't quite seem like it's like he's being real. And, you know, it's so unbelievable what a nice guy this guy is and how he's so willing to share his knowledge with everybody. Here's a clip from his show on the Brewing Network.
Hey, Sean, I'm a faithful Brewing Network listener. I love your new show, and I can't wait till the next episode. Unfortunately, I live in Bangkok, where homebrewing is next to impossible and possibly illegal, and good beer is hard to find. I have some friends visiting from the States in a few weeks, and I thought they could bring a few ounces of hops along. So, besides making hop salt, which you've mentioned, what recipes can you suggest that would go well with hops, and what hops should I suggest they bring?
Wow, this could be a whole show. So I'm okay. Sorry, Matt, I'm not going to be able to answer everything here. But hops are really fun. You could easily do, if you put about a half an ounce of hops into an SIS whipped cream canister and fill it up with a little bit of vodka or water, hit that up with a little bit of nitrous and shake that up for about 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. The longer it sits, the more flavor you're going to get. And take that and actually add it into lemonade, make a hop lemonade. You can also use that to add into mashed potatoes. Yep. You can use it a lot of different ways, and that will give a really nice hop flavor. Actually, on my website, there's a roasted garlic IPA mashed potatoes that works really, really well with hops. You could also do something as simple as, you know, using that hop extract, if you will, and playing around with it in other dishes. So you don't want to cook it too much, but at the very end, you could put that into mustard. You could put it into all kinds of things, and that's a really nice way to cook with hops.
Okay.
You know, you can always email me if you have certain questions, for sure, but I don't want to really dumb it down too much because I really want this show to be for everybody, from the home brewer to the chef to the foodie to just the casual listener or the person who's curious about beer, and I really want it to be for everybody, you know, and I'm also trying to do a show that I want to listen to.
Sure.
And that's where I might talk a little bit more higher level of, you know, culinary stuff, but I want you to feel like, hey, wait a minute here, let's look that up because that might sound interesting, and the mascarpone or the sauvignon or this or that, you know, they're really pretty easy stuff to learn, and we can easily teach you that too. So, you know, if you guys have questions or want a recipe, I can easily help you with that too.
Another Sean wrote in, hey Sean, I've made several attempts at hop infused oil, something to be used on a pasta or to dip bread in, but they've all ended in failure. I was wondering if you've ever done an infused oil or light sauce with hops.
Or butter.
That could be used for that purpose. Thanks again for teaming up with the BN. Looking forward to shows from Sean. What do you think?
Well, the big thing is how long you cook it and how long and at what temperature. So it's actually better to not bring your oil or butter to an actual simmer. If you keep it at a lower temperature, like let's say 180 to 190. Because, I mean, think about when you put hops in a boil, right? You're boiling it for anywhere between 90 minutes, 60 minutes, 30 minutes. It really changes. And the flavors actually change. And when you're trying to get those flavors, especially, you know, if you're doing something like for like a olive oil bread, you know, garlic kind of thing. If you want to use more of your aromatic hops, let's say your Centennial or your Amarillo or a few other things like that, you can actually go ahead and bring that temperature, you know, anywhere between, you know, 190 to 200 degrees. You really don't want to simmer it, and that's going to add a lot of flavor as it sits. And I would use about a cup to two cups of oil or butter, and then probably about quarter cup or so of hops. You don't want to put too much in. And if you do it with butter, it's actually really great on popcorn. Do a hot buttered popcorn.
Oh, that sounds great.
And then, you know, that's always fun with a good movie. So,
of course. That's fun with everything.
And we saw Sean for breakfast Friday when we were up in Sonoma. And he was doing something at Russian River Brewing, and I got a chance to meet Vinny Coluzzo. And he took us to a diner for breakfast. And I say diner, listen to this. It featured local produce in their dishes and an actual chef that made some really incredible breakfast food. This is, you walk into a diner like this and you see a rack, and the rack has Bon Appetit, Savoir, you know, a bunch of food magazines. Just amazing. You know you're in a place that's going to serve something really decent. And I had a very basic breakfast, scrambled eggs, hash browns, and duck confit over grilled apples. Imagine having duck confit for breakfast. It was it was startling, but it was great. I can't tell you. No, and I ordered the same thing as Sean did, and Sean said, oh, I want béarnaise with that. And I go, béarnaise, really? I'll have béarnaise. And sure enough, I made béarnaise. Light and fluffy, fantastic. That's cooking. But that's what it's like up there. I mean, this is what I said before when I went to visit. It's like I'm living in the wrong place. My show would be 10 times more interesting if I lived up there. I'd have a lot more to say. I'd have a lot more stories to share. And I think it would actually make me a better cook to be up there, to use those ingredients. So I kind of think that that's maybe why Sean has stayed there. Because it does. He's constantly thinking about food. Because it's all around him. It's good stuff. Farm to table, man. I'm not kidding. It's amazing. But Sean, you know, I'll get on the phone with him. He'll spend telling me all these dishes he made. He'll do these beer dinners that are maybe, you know, 15, 16 courses. And each course has got like 60 ingredients. He'll make mustards and different condiments with the beer that he's serving to pair the beer with. I mean, he really thinks about this stuff. And it's really deep. And a lot of times the beer is really rare. So it's not like, you know, you're going in and you're going to experiment and make some poo and screw up a good beer and waste good beer. I mean, this guy is a professional. He really knows his stuff. So I'm learning a lot from him. And I really feel honored to call him a friend, really, because Rick Sellers hooked me up with him because you got to meet this guy. And of course, you know, people start saying, oh, you got to meet this person, you'll like him, or, you know, this guy's amazing, and then you meet him, and it usually is a letdown. Well, that wasn't the case with Sean, not even close. So his show on the Brewing Network, it's on Fridays, and he's only done two so far, and it's a live show, so it's not like this. With me, I sit in my studio in my room here, and I do my thing, and I can go back, and I can add stuff to it. No, he's got to do it, like, on a gun. So, and he's got a really great pace. He's got a lot to say. He's interesting. And I, you know, that's a lot more than I can say for a lot of people who try to do stuff like this, because it's not easy. So First Lady Michelle Obama had something to say to restaurants recently.
So today I'm going to talk about food, which is something that all of you here today know a little bit about. Together, you represent 40% of the nearly 1 million restaurants in the United States. From the biggest chains to the smallest diners. You know what Americans like to eat and what they don't. You've seen how the ingredients we put in our bodies affect the way we feel and the way we feel about ourselves. And you also understand the unique role that food And restaurants especially play in our own lives and in the life of our nation. And as America's restaurant owners, you're responsible for one-third of the calories our kids get on a daily basis. The choices you make determine what's listed on the menus, what's advertised on billboards, and what's served on our plates. And your decisions about how a dish is prepared, what goes into it, and where is it placed on the menu, that can have a real impact on the way people eat. And that's why we need your help. And we need your help now. Because when you see research showing that obese toddlers already display some warning signs for heart disease, it's clear that we just don't have the time to waste. It starts with offering healthier options designed specifically for kids. And today, no matter what kind of restaurant you visit, whether it's Italian, French, Mexican, American, most kids' menus look pretty much the same. And trust me, we've seen a lot of them. One local survey found that 90% of those menus includes mac and cheese, our children's favorite. 80% includes chicken fingers. 60% includes burgers or cheeseburgers. Some options weigh in at over 1,000 calories. And that's close to the recommended amounts that a child should have for the entire day. And I think, and I know you all think, that our kids deserve better than that. That's why I want to challenge every restaurant to offer healthy menu options and then provide them up front so that parents don't have to hunt around and read the small print to find an appropriately sized portion that doesn't contain high levels of fat, salt, and sugar.
Now, in that audio clip, what I didn't hear that I read was that she was telling restaurants to use less cream and butter. And when I read that, I thought, are you fucking kidding me? You know, I love you when you tell kids to eat their vegetables, when you plant that garden, when you promoted growing your own foods and eating better. But when it comes to cream and butter, it might be time to just kind of close it. These are two key elements in proper French cuisine, and I'll be damned if we're going to live without them. But again, it's all about the kids. Kids, one-third of the food that they eat comes from their restaurants. Why is that? It wasn't that way when I was growing up. We ate at home. I mean, what the hell's going on? This all about the kids stuff. Now restaurants have to tailor their menus to kids? Guess what, First Lady? F*** you. Here's an idea. How about you don't eat at restaurants if you've got a problem with cream and butter? Or maybe, you know, you should just be cooking at home. If there's anything I hate more than politicians, it's politicians who try to tell me how to live, what to say, how to eat, and how to do business. I didn't stand for it when Tipper Gore and the PMRC came after Prince for his lyrics, and I'm sure as hell not going to stand for this. I don't like that. I don't get it, and I don't think it's her place. I don't think it's anyone's place. Let's just let the people decide. Instead of telling restaurants what to put on their menu, just don't go if you see the food is unhealthy. They've got to tailor kids' menus. Look, it's a very romantic notion to think that you're going to have more restaurants like Zazu and the Linkery and a lot of farm-to-table places. But that just doesn't happen. And it's not going to happen because that doesn't sell. Kids don't want to eat that stuff because you don't feed them that way at home. The reason they're hooked on mac and cheese is because you're shoving mac and cheese up their face all the time. Kid cries, so you give him what he wants. Butter and cheese. But it's not your responsibility. Oh, hell no. Let's make the restaurants do the right thing. When they're at home, they're going to eat whatever the hell they want. Bullshit. Oh, here's another one. Let me get this straight. It's no longer called high fructose corn syrup? That sucks. It was so, I don't know, catchy. Didn't we just talk about this a couple months ago? I played this story on the show where supporters of high fructose corn syrup came right out and said that it didn't contain amounts of glucose higher than regular table sugar. But that doesn't matter because we've given them so much bad press that now they're on the mat. Only a company or an organization or group of organizations who's pinned to the mat would try to change their name to get out of the bad light. I'll give you some examples. Do you remember Singular, the cell phone service? They sucked. In fact, they still suck. Now they're called AT&T. How about Philip Morris? That was a name everybody knew about them, right? They gave people cancer. That name was as good as mud after a while, so they changed it to Altria. You don't hear people talking about Altria, do you? No, because no one knows who the hell they are. They're Philip Morris. People will only change their name to avoid bad publicity in most cases. You stop calling it high fructose corn syrup, start calling it corn sugar, and suddenly that sounds healthy, almost organic. People are going to read the labels and they're going to say corn sugar. I don't know, it sounds natural. Because people, for the most part, are stupid, and they'll buy any amount of bullshit that you throw at them. Walmart? Hey, they sell organic foods now. They're awesome. They're like Microsoft. Such a great company. Wonderful technical support. And look at how many people are using Microsoft products to this day. And they're not that great. They must be doing something right. Of course they are. They marketed well in the mid-90s, and people never let it go. Should you avoid products containing high fructose corn syrup? Yeah, if you can avoid them. Sometimes, if it's too inconvenient and it's just this one time, fine. Do what you want. I'm certainly not going to tell you not to eat something. I'm no Michelle Obama. I just thought it was hilarious that they changed their name, and this comes maybe less than 2 months after they, you know, tried to do damage control.
Rosemary Jones drives 12 miles to this weekly exercise and cooking class in South Los Angeles. Then she shops for fresh produce at a farmer's market in the same neighborhood city hall, because there's nothing like this where she lives.
I don't have health insurance, so I get free exercise, plus I'm exposed to fresh food and it makes a big difference in my life.
She's lost weight and her back problems are gone. Enrique Quintero has dropped 12 pounds. Like many here, he's struggled for years with his weight and with dwindling local food options.
How difficult was it to eat healthy?
Well, everyday life in the city is so fast that you get hungry and you just eat anywhere you see a fast food restaurant. And that was a major cause of my weight gain.
2 years ago, the Los Angeles City Council passed a moratorium on new fast food restaurants in South LA because a county study found 30% of the population here was obese. The farmer's market, which accepts federal food assistance checks, was another step.
Well, I wanted to respond quickly to the issues related to childhood obesity, to the lack of food choices, and this was a fast way to come in, put together a farmer's market, reach out to people who require some form of federal assistance and those who don't, and to bring fresh fruits and vegetables right in here at our neighborhood city hall.
The bigger challenge, attracting supermarkets to the area. The 1992 Los Angeles riots hastened a decades-long exodus of major food retailers.
There are plenty of good deals on beer here at this neighborhood market in South Los Angeles. And across the street, another store is advertising liters of soda for 99 cents. For years, these were the only grocery shopping options for residents of this community. In fact, a 2002 study found that in an area encompassing five entire zip codes and more than 125,000 residents, there were no full-service supermarkets. But since the city passed a moratorium on new fast food restaurants in this area, two new supermarkets have moved in, bringing healthy food options to this community for the first time in decades.
This fresh and easy market opened in February as part of a larger residential and retail development.
We believe whether you live on the West LA side of California or in South LA, you should have the right to the same types of quality fresh foods and vegetables.
There weren't stores that had the quality of food that you really needed. I ended up gaining a bunch of weight just because of the quality of food that was here.
They had like more organic stuff, more healthier choices, like besides the regular markets that they have around. So I think it's good for the community.
And good for business. Fresh and Easy says it's pleased with the performance of its South LA store, and it's considering opening more locations nearby. Casey Wyand, CNN, Los Angeles.
You know, while I was playing that audio, I looked back and I saw it was episode 2 where I did that walkthrough at the farmer's market with my little iPod. I wanted to play that for you guys because it kind of brings me back to memory lane. The first day that I had the wool pulled over my eyes, it was in July of 2007.
Let's get a dozen eggs. A dozen eggs? You guys own the chickens that laid these eggs? Nice. Where's your farm at? Carvin?
Arvin,
where is that?
Like a few minutes from Bakersfield.
Okay. Wow, you drove them all the way out here? That's dedication to your craft. How big's your farm?
80 acres.
80 acres? Nice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice. That eggplant kind of has its own spicy flavor. It's a little bit peppery in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, do you grow all this stuff yourself? Mm-hmm. Where do you grow it?
Fresno.
Fresno?
Yeah, very far.
And you drove it all the way down here?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow, that's dedication.
Very hard.
How big is your farm? How big is your farm? The farm where you grow all your stuff?
Acres?
How many acres?
Very big.
Very big? So big you can't even measure it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Where is this growing?
Nepomo, San Luis Obispo.
Oh, San Luis Obispo?
That's a drive.
Yeah. Surprised you guys drive all the way out here for this.
Yeah, one day, every Saturday.
Every Saturday?
Yeah.
How long does it take you to get down here?
3 hours.
3 hours?
I start driving almost 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock?
Yeah.
Wow. So all this stuff is grown all in pretty much the same?
Yeah, with the family ranch.
Oh, nice. How many acres do you own out there?
200.
200 acres? Unbelievable.
So as I said, we visited Sonoma again last week, as we do pretty much every year around this time, for the most part. And for those of you who have never visited what we call wine country, it's magical. And it's not just about wine. And you say, you know, go to Sonoma, Napa, people say, I wouldn't want to go there. I'm not really all into wine. I go, it's not just about wine. In fact, after a while, it's not about wine at all. You can only do so much wine tasting before it just becomes, I don't care to do it anymore. No, it's about food. It's about amazing country, farms, animals, nice people, very quaint. I mean, you can really relax up there. It's magic, man. And it's not about wine tasting, you know. People always think you can only do so much of that, like I said. You drink in sample after sample of wine, but sooner or later, you just want to drink a glass of wine and chill out. Instead, it's one huge prick tease. A little taste of this. A little taste of this. It's like going from place to place, getting a little foreplay. But sooner or later, you know, you just can't help yourself. You need to get laid. Well, that's what wine tasting is. It's just one jerk after another. But I know it not be the classiest way of describing it, but yeah, there it is. As we did last year, we ate at both Ad Hoc and Zazu restaurant for dinner, and we had Bavolo for breakfast. And of course, as expected, you know something that works, you go right to it. And because it's not something we can do all the time, I mean, we get one chance a year to go to these places. We don't want to pass them up. And sometimes we don't even get to go every year. Dusky, who's the head chef at Zazu, is going to be featured on Next Iron Chef America on Food Network, October 3rd. So when we're there, I ask her, you know, what can you tell me? She goes, there is nothing she can really say, but she'll answer any questions that I ask. So I told her I understood, as I did. You know, Chris Koniak told me that Food Network, you know, they own you. Once you're on, they own you. And she told me that she's theirs for the next 3 years. And that's exactly what Koniak told me. Hungry detective. Couldn't do anything. For 3 years afterward. So, if in a way, Food Network is a blessing and a curse. But what are you going to do? You're on Food Network. So, I don't know how far she made it, but I urge you all to watch, because all of a sudden now, Food Network's got something I want to watch. So, we had John Salumi again, as we did last year. And I learned recently, going in, that he went to Armandino Batali, who's Mario's father. Armandino is his name. Because Armandino is the guy who runs Salumi in Seattle. Because, you know, he's a salumist, a master salumist, a really talented salumist. So when we had it again this time, having already had Senior Batali Salumi just a month ago up in Seattle, I was like, dude, this is not only as good as I remember it, but it's better than Batali Salumi. So I asked Dusky while we were there, I go, you know, what did, so he learned from Armandino. You know what she told me? Armandino told John, I don't teach chefs how to make salumi. It's like they wouldn't understand. So Mario decides to take him under his wing because they're friends. And the clincher is when Senior Batali sees the tattoo on John's arm, which just happens to be the Salumi logo on Armandino's signage in front of his shop in Seattle. Big pig on his arm. The guy's got tattoos everywhere, but this is kind of killer. I would certainly put that on my arm, no problem. And there you have it. A star is born. And I swear to you, the more I learn about the Batalis, the more I love these people. And for that matter, Dusky and John. But the meal we had at Zazu last year, as I said here on the show, was a total game changer for me. We're all into the farm-to-table thing, but this was something I had never tasted in my life. The meal, this time, we went for the low fruit, for the simple stuff, because I wanted to see what Dusky could do without the benefits of protein. So we had the plate of John Salumi, which doesn't count, but give me a break. What am I going to do? Pass that up? You know, you don't get an opportunity to have that all the time. Then we ordered a simple salad, a Caesar salad to start. Impeccable, because the salad was fresh, the sauce was just right, the dressing, fresh lettuce, crispy croutons, butter all over everything. And to follow that up, we had spicy tomato soup with a grilled cheese sandwich that featured Bellwether cheese. And that's a farm that we're familiar with because I can get their creme fraiche here at Trader Joe's. They carry it. And we just purchased the very cheese that was in the sandwich when we visited Preston Winery in Dry Creek the day before. And that was heaven in my belly. I can only say that much. It was just nourishing and unassuming and just very good. And she can just cook simple stuff or really difficult stuff. But it just felt like I was having a big family meal at a regular place. But the food was gourmet. I can't say enough about Sonoma that I haven't really said already. But I'll say this. If you're really in tune with your food, natural food, fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, eating proteins from animals that are raised and slaughtered in the most humane ways possible, traditional farm life, as natural as things come, Sonoma and Napa are not only the place to live, it's probably the place to die. I got to think that if people spend their lives there, living the way they do, they'll have to die with smiles on their faces. Because how could you not, living that way, living where you live? Think about it. If I told you you were going to die in the next 30 minutes and you had a chance to go where you would end your life, are you going to pick a cold hospital room in a concrete jungle like Los Angeles or Chicago, some big city, or a small family village in wine country? You know, it only makes sense. That area just feels right. There's no doubt about it. When you go there, you just know that, you know, the place just feels organic and natural. And there's nothing not to like about it. Of course, if you're into city life, it's not for you. And, you know, you're going to be in a hurry to get out. But for us, it's a place of solace. And I like that about that place. Of course, we ate it ad hoc while we were up there, too, because we can't pass that up. And we had bone marrow, Bourdain's death dish, his final dish. His last supper is roasted bone marrow with a parsley salad and toast points. And that came as one of our entrees. Optional, and we totally ordered it. And it was amazing. And Katrina ate it. You know what I called it? You know what I said it tasted like? Meat butter. Because that's exactly what it was. It was very rich, but it tasted almost funky, but very meaty. Man, that was nuts. That meal was nuts. They made Chateaubriand and served us way too much meat. And we had an amazing salad and some cheese that kind of resembled Humboldt Fog in a way. It had that nice line of ash down the middle. And it was really kind of super creamy and just thinking about it. Anyway, just another great time in Sonoma, and I can't wait to go back. And with that, I'm out of here. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be doing the Halloween episode next. That's coming up very soon. And I have no idea what I'm going to do, but we'll be doing something. And I'll see you then for that. I owe one of my listeners something. It's on the way. You know who you are, and you'll get it soon. Music in this episode by Stereophonics. If you like the song, you can buy it in the iTunes store from their website, stereophonics.com. Check mylifeasafoodie.com for details. Thanks to CNN.com and Universal Pictures for the sound bites. My apologies to Warner Brothers and the creators of The Hangover taking liberties with their film. I'm sorry. Please don't sue me. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you next time.
I just turned 26 and she was 23. She wore a crucifix but never preached at me. We'd stay up all night until the day was dead. I'd get the fear of God inside my broken head. Wanna fly away and change.
honey here. Holy crap, there's music. American Idol is just ruining this country.